Hello and welcome to the Wise Children Podcast. I'm in the office and I'm with Simon Baker.
Hello.
Unusually for us, it's Saturday.
Yeah, I thought we'd shake it up this week, do it on Saturday.
I like it.
See how that feels.
I like it. The sun's shining.
Yeah.
And I guess that gives you a bit of time tomorrow to get this out.
Maybe. Let's see if we can race it. We've got to do this one properly as well because we're sending this to the RSC.
Ah.
Why are we sending it to the RSC?
This podcast is being sent to the RSC because it's about our new co-production with the RSC. And our new production is a new adaptation of the amazing, iconic novel, The Buddha of Suburbia, written by Hanif Qureshi. And it's been adapted by me with Hanif. It's so exciting. I know I always sound like a kid in a sweet shop. But this really, really, this novel has been a massive part of my life for a very, very long time. I feel it's a witness of a world that matters a lot to me. But it isn't only my world, it's through a different lens. It's such an important novel. It's so funny. It is so rude. And it's so relevant. And I can't really believe my luck that I've had the chance to adapt it. Not only to adapt it, but to adapt it with Hanif. So I'm delighted to say Hanif is now a big part of my life. But we're doing it at the RSC and we're going to be the first production on the Swan stage in Daniel Evans and Tamara Harvey's first season.
So no pressure then. Absolutely no pressure.
But the thing is, you know me, I don't feel pressure until it hits me over like a truck.
I know.
So I'm not feeling the stress. I am honestly just feeling the absolute delight. I've got a fabulous, fabulous company.
I think that the company is great.
It's a glorious mixed bag of old collaborators and new. So from the Emma Rice old guard, we've got Ewan Wardrop, who was in Rebecca and Midsummer Night's Dream, yeah, amongst others. We've got Anko Bahl, who was also in Midsummer Night's Dream and in The Empress. Dear friend Anko. We've got Beatrice Jones, who was in Wise Children. Lucy Thackray, who was in Midsummer Night's Dream. Rina Fatania, who I worked with on The Empress. So we've got a really fabulous core team of old collaborators. And Rina did Varvar Girls.
She did.
In 2012, as well as Natasha Jayatalika. So those two go back to 2012.
Yeah.
So I've got this amazing, fantastic core team of brilliant, funny, fabulous performers. And then, of course, I got some new ones.
Mm-hmm.
So the company, I'm going to say it, is being led by Dee Alawalia, who is playing Karima Mia,
yeah,
who is the narrator of The Buddha of Suburbia. And he's got a massive task, Dee.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant, brilliant young actor, but oh my goodness, he's got all the words.
I was watching him the other day. It's huge. It is. I think you described it as kind of the modern Hamlet.
Well, I think it is. I mean, Hanif's book is an epic domestic novel. It's kind of in five acts.
Yeah.
And there's this unreliable narrator at the centre of it, which is Karim. So it's a huge job. And he goes through such a big emotional journey. And Dee is phenomenal. He's phenomenal. And not only is he a beautiful star in the making, but oh my goodness, he works hard.
Yeah.
He's come in off book every day.
Yeah. Pretty incredible.
And he is playing against Tommy Belshaw.
Yeah.
Again, very young, just out of Bristol Old Vic Drama School.
Yeah.
Not just out, but recently out. And he's absolutely gorgeous, playing Charlie, really twinkly. I've got Simon Rivers in the company, who's, oh, his first time I've worked with Simon, and he's fantastically naughty.
Yeah.
Raj Bajaj, first time I've worked with him. He is off the naughty chart,
yeah,
can I say?
Yeah.
And I've also got Devon Moda. So what a company.
They are great.
We are whacking the ball around a lot. We are laughing a lot.
They're incredibly competitive at volleyball. We've been playing with some non-competitive people quite recently, but playing volleyball with that lot is a little bit like being back at knee high.
Yeah, and I had to remind you of that. You said you thought they were competitive, and I was like, can you remember knee high?
I did, and it suddenly all came flooding back.
Again. But you know that's why I play ball at the beginning of the day, is,
yeah,
it gets all the emotions out.
Yeah.
If you're feeling frustrated, you can get your frustrated out. If you're feeling angry, you can get your anger out. If you don't really feel like joining in, kind of the magnet of the game pulls you out of yourself and into the room, you know, and it's an amazing leveler ball. And but yeah, there's a lot of it being played and a lot of fun being had. So it's been an intoxicating 2 weeks. What are the downsides, dear listeners? The downside is it's another massive novel. I mean, I'm going to say now, I'm not going to do another massive novel on the back of Wuthering Heights and Angela Carter's Wise Children doing The Buddha of Suburbia. Oh my goodness, it's such a big job, sort of mathematically, to get that number of pages down into a 2.5 hour event, but narratively as well. So we were talking about Dee, you know, leading the company as Kareem. You know, he has to lead us. I mean, heaven forbid if you forgot a scene, you could skip 5 years, couldn't you? So it's a massive learning job and it's a massive adaptation job. So we are having fun, but obviously I'm the adapter and director, which means I've sort of got two eyes on it the whole time. I'm looking at the performances and the way the show's coming together, but I'm also thinking, am I taking the audience with me? Is this beat useful? It's definitely too long, so I'm looking for cuts at the moment, which is, of course, the thing I hate most in life, because I'm a yes-and person, and I want every effect, every dance routine, every bit of music, every pleasure known to man or beast. And actually, in order to not have 4 hours of material and everybody crying, I have to be really rigorous.
It's impressive you know that now, that it's probably too long, at the end of week two. Because certainly I've worked on productions and you kind of don't really know how long it is until dress rehearsal one. But you did, because you had act one almost on its feet pretty much by the end of last week.
Yeah.
Maybe the beginning of this week.
Yeah, but I was just thinking I'm going to sound a bit... I mean, I, as you know, I am almost entirely untrained and know absolutely nothing. So given my CV of nothingness, the thing I've learned, I've got an inbuilt theatre clock. Just have. I feel it. I know, you know I'm...
Yeah, you're very conscious of it all the time, aren't you?
Yeah.
What the time is.
But it's not that I'm conscious of it. I feel it. I feel like I'm a walking theatre clock. I know when it's 5 minutes.
Mm.
I know when it's 15 minutes. I know when it's an hour.
Yeah.
And those are all really massive moments. I bore everybody with this all the time. But you have to be... You have to have got the audience on side after 5 minutes and you have to get them hooked by 15.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're going to go over an hour... You have to be really exciting at an hour.
Yeah.
You can't do a slow fizzle out into an interval. You have to push through. That's known. It's not learned. That's what I know. And I know it from being on stage and I know it from being in the rehearsal room. And that's how I know it. I can feel it in my bones now. And of course, it's really slow at the moment because actors, it's the way as you build a character, you know, you're going to start slow and then build up the pace and the show will become defter and defter. I know what it will become.
Yeah, yeah.
I can still feel it.
And it's much easier to start weeding stuff out in the rehearsal room than it is when you get onto stage.
Well, that is something I've learned with experience. As a younger director, I felt really... protective. I was going to say precious, but not precious. I felt protective of the work that had been made and protective of my actors that had made it. So I'd feel the tragedy of cutting. And of course it is a bit tragic if you cut in performance because people have worked hard, but I've learned to do my homework and to cut as early as possible. And the script is in good shape. So there's not a lot of fat in it.
No.
So I've already done my homework, but now I'm really trying to make sure that we really take into performance the material that we're going to take into performance.
It's also really hard to cut by the time you've got on stage. It takes forever as well, because you've got so many other... When it's just you in the room with the company, it becomes one thing to try and cut something. By the time you've got on stage and there's 30 other people working on it, it becomes really difficult.
It would have a name, didn't it? Something's Law.
Yeah, I can think of a few. I think when I was working on Lord of the Rings about a million years ago, and it was way too long, I think it was so complicated. I think we kind of worked out it took us a 4-hour call to take out 1.5 minutes of time on the show. And we were trying to lose 30 minutes out of the show. So you can just kind of do the maths and go, we are going to run out of time.
Should we call it Gollum's Law then?
Gollum's Law.
Which is true though, because at the beginning of a process, anything can happen really quickly. You're light on your feet, but like you say, by the end of the process, it's an absolute tanker.
Yeah, it's really hard when you start cutting on stage, because it, and it also becomes slightly frustrating, because what you're trying to do is improve the show during previews, for example. And if you're spending all your time trying to take things out, you never actually get to fix the things that are wrong. So, very impressive that you managed to cut in the rehearsal room.
Well, this I've learned.
Very good.
Cut early.
Yeah.
Cut early.
Good tip.
Yeah. That is my tip for the
day. That's in your book.
Cut early.
How's that coming along, by the way?
You're very rude to me.
So we talked about the cast. There's one person in the cast which I am sort of slightly fearful for, because he has the biggest job of everybody, which is your one understudy.
Oh, yeah, Devon.
Devon.
Yeah.
Who is kind of covering everything.
It's the new idea, or my new idea, because we're doing the same in Bluebeard.
That's right, yeah.
And it's, so far it's working really well, which is to declare it. There's a new thing, which is really post-COVID, which is certainly in the midst of COVID, when the industry was trying to get back on its feet, understudies were going on all the time. And I think that was because people had COVID.
Yeah.
People had long COVID.
Yeah.
And we were fearful, weren't we? We were all very fearful, and not only fearful for our own health, but it was really noticeable that we were fearful of giving germs to other people, which is a new thing. I mean, I remember performing like so ill.
Yeah.
And just dragging myself onto stage, and there was not a single thought about passing it on to
you. You're about to make everybody else.
Yeah, you know, you'd be kissing and rubbing and doing whatever you had to do. It didn't even cross our minds that, you know, we were just thinking the show must go on.
Yeah.
So lots of good things happened in COVID. They were challenging, but I think we are no longer in a world where if you are too ill to perform, you can't perform, which is, I would say, an absolute step forward in an industry that has been historically brutal. But at the worst stage of post-pandemic, you couldn't get enough understudies, because often you might have, well, a company like Wise Children would have had no understudies pre-pandemic, but then we decided we'd have two, and that wouldn't be enough because the breadth of parts, so you up that to four. But then, they might be covering three roles each. So what happens if two people go off and they're both covered by the same understudy? So it was really, it was a house of cards, which was falling down really quickly. But we're coming out of it. You can feel history changing under your fingertips. And you can feel the fear dropping away. You can feel the industry changing. But you still have to be able to keep the show on the road. So the new idea is that you have one understudy who's absolutely the heart of the company, who would cover every role on book. So not in costume, not saying that you're declaring to the audience, this is not an either or, we're not swapping this person in. We're saying there's somebody off and this person is going to read brilliantly.
Yeah.
And it's quite fun.
Yeah.
Because Devon's a gorgeous young man who will also be playing a middle-aged woman and an older man, you know, is playing everything. So I think the audience will enjoy it.
Mm.
And Devon's brilliant as well. So I think it needs to be declared at the beginning, carrying a book, but yeah, playing all the parts.
It's very exciting.
It is really good. It's a massive job. He needs to literally be on top of the entire show and all the tracks.
Yeah.
When we call it a track is the... Well, it's literally like the tracks in a snow of a fox, is that if you were to follow one act around their whole show, their track would be going onto stage, going into the dressing room, putting a wig on, you know, and that understudy will need to learn every one of those tracks in the snow.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because actors' tracks, we don't often think about it, but in your shows, they're incredibly complicated, because it's about sofas coming on and the right prop being handed to the right person, and any one of those things gets missed, then the scene suddenly starts to fall apart.
When all the costume changes, I don't know when it happened, but my shows at the moment have got so many costume changes.
I know.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But it's going to be a ball. It's going to be...
It's going to be great.
It's very meaty, The Buddha of Suburbia. It's a family drama in the 1970s. It's gritty. It's about the experience of South Asians in London at that time. But it's also very funny. And of course, the other link that it's got to my other work is Kareem, our hero, gets a job in theatre, which is a whole other magnificent world that we go into, the world of the 1970s theatre. But it is a sort of brother to Wise Children. It's another, I want to say love letter to theatre, but it's less romantic than Angela Carter. It's a difficult relationship, I think, but it's still a really important relationship, and it's edgier. But there's still a glorious, glorious theatrical world to explore.
And it's important to kind of, I suppose, stress that it's in 1979, which to us doesn't feel that long ago. But to many people that come and see it, they won't remember the 1979 at all. They won't remember the 70s at all.
No, it's actually 76 to 79. We do remember it because it was our formative years.
Childhood, yeah.
You're younger than me, but it was our childhood. And of course, a bit of you will always be stuck in your childhood.
Yeah.
So it's very vivid. But yeah, the book, this adaptation starts in 75, I think. I can't remember if it was 75 or 6 off the top.
Yeah.
But it finishes on the eve of the election that Thatcher goes on to win. So it's a real pivotal moment and really fantastically relevant to now, where we're teetering on the edge of an election as well. And whereas in 79, we were about to go from the left to the right, please, we're about to go the other way. Just thinking, my biggest memory of that time was the power cuts.
Yeah.
Which, as a kid, were such good fun. I mean, you'd sort of live for that moment. And then my dad, who was forever the enthusiast, he always had crazes. And because of the strikes, he taught himself how to make candles.
Of course he did.
And it couldn't just be an ordinary candle. He had to make novelty candles. So we had a few disasters. One favourite one was he filled a marigold glove with wax, but he found it really hard to thread the wicks up through the fingers. So that was a failed project. But then he did a really big low dish with lots of wicks in it, which he was really pleased. And he lit that, but it just became one massive dish of fire. So we had to go out into the garden instead of setting fire to the house. But of course, presumably for my mum and dad, it was probably a bit stressful. But as kids, it was fabulous.
But you're right, we should do a power cut.
We should.
At some point, yeah.
There should be a psst moment.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the music.
Yes.
Because the novel is set in the 70s, and Hanif has got such a strong relationship to music.
Yeah.
Music is woven throughout the book and referenced throughout the book. And one of the characters, Charlie, is in a band and then becomes a punk rocker. So it's very real.
Yeah.
And it's been really enjoyable. We're making a score, aren't we? There's no live musicians in this.
No.
Which is a departure for me. But there's a reason for it, which is that I really, really want the sounds of the 70s to anchor it in that time.
Yeah.
But what we have done is I've been working with my friend and amazing composer, Niraj Shag, who worked on Varvar Girls with us in 2012. Amazing composer who's done several themes for us. So it has got an authentic, contemporary, new voice that glues together all the other songs of the 70s and earlier. And I think it's going to be really dynamic. And I also really wanted the big sound of a recorded soundtrack. Because we reference Bollywood. You cannot do Bollywood with three musicians.
No.
It's big. This is a big world, and it's a filmic world. And Kareem's, he's almost Dickensian as he sort of goes through windows and journeys through London. And I really want the score to represent that. So we've got some Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go too specific because what else have we got? We've got some Etta James, got some Joni Mitchell.
A little bit of Bee Gees.
Bee Gees, Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
Got some punk rock in there.
A little bit of Joan Armour Trading.
Yes.
The punk rock's good fun. One of the great joys and therefore challenges of being the sound designer is often finding that one piece of found music which sums up exactly the period you're in, the location you're in, and the mood that you're in. And pre-recorded music is great at doing that, I think. I think found tracks in shows used correctly are really good. They also present a challenge because when you work with a composer, you can sculpt a piece of music around a scene. So you might have lots of big interest to get you into the scene, and then the vocal might drop away or the theme might drop away, and you're then just revealing a very simplified version, which is maybe just the chords or something, or just a rhythmic thing which can sit under dialogue quite well. And then at the end of the scene, you might transition out and it becomes something big and elegant. Pre-recorded music, of course, you don't have those tools available to you, so you're constantly looking at how you might break them up, restructure them, glue them with other things, or, you know, in our case, gluing them back together with Niraj's work. So they're a kind of challenge, but when done right, there's nothing more fun, I think, than finding the right piece of music for a scene.
And you're a master at it, Simon. I mean, we know that sound is the dark art of theatre, so I don't really know how you do it, but you take these tracks and then you watch the scenes and you manage to weave them round, knead them in like bread. It's amazing. It's amazing. And of course, you've got this encyclopedic knowledge of music, which I love. And in fact, there was a lovely relationship moment, wasn't there, where we did a scene and we hadn't chosen. And I said, we need a... I wanted it then and there, didn't I? I always do. And I said, we need something. We need something more romantic. And then first of all, we were trying to remember who sang Loving You.
Yeah.
And I was trying to sing it. And look it up now if you want to. It's the most beautiful song of all time. And I was trying to sing it in the highest soprano. Dogs of Clapham could hear me. Yeah. And it's Minnie Riperton.
Yeah.
And you said, no, I don't think it's that. It needs a little bit more nuance. And you landed Rolls Royce, Wish Upon a Star.
Yeah.
And it's perfect. It's just absolutely perfect. But I love those moments between us because we both love our music, don't we?
Oh, and I was so relieved that I got slightly worried as I was looking for it. And I had to go and check my dates on Discogs to make sure it came out in the right year.
But, and it did.
Yeah, we're fine. 76. Phew. Finding pre-recorded music's great. I love it when music in a scene comes from somewhere. I kind of record players and radios are always great. And they're good for two different reasons. A radio, if you use a radio on set, it can always be a surprise what comes out of it because you're never quite sure what you're going to tune into on a radio. So you can discover all kinds of bits of music for a character on stage. So you can often sneak a surprising piece of music into a scene because it happens to be on the radio. Records need thought because you have to choose to put a record on. It's a thing.
Very interesting.
So there's a sort of... The character has already pre-decided what piece of music they're going to play.
See, now I'm thinking, because we've got a record player, but now I'm thinking, should we have a radio?
Well, radio is good for that, because you can be surprised by a radio.
What about in Paradise Stores? Do you think Jeter and Anwar might listen to the radio?
I think so. Mm. Yeah. We should have a look at that.
We should play some of the music.
I was just thinking, we have Niraj. What we actually asked Niraj to do is we gave him sort of five themes to write. And he's written these great big epic scores. And Niraj is so good at it because he instinctively knows what I'm going to ask for and has already done it. So I'm going to say, but Niraj, it'd be great if there's a kind of great 30 seconds or great 36 seconds I can use. And actually, when you break down all of his tracks, they're kind of all there. They're all kind of chaptered.
Amazing.
You just have to sort of slightly unearth it a bit. So yeah, we're going to play some of... We've got... the thing we are going to play is Cream's theme, which was, I think, one of the first pieces we asked Niraj to write, which was to imagine, if this was a movie, what would Cream sound like as he walked through 1979 London?
Oh,
great bit of music. And the other theme I think we should play is Niraj's homage to old Bollywood.
Oh, yes. Which has got my beautiful Japjit Kaur singing the vocals.
Yeah.
Japjit, who did Little Match Girl with me at the Globe.
Yeah.
And the Empress and Valvar Girls.
She was in Valvar Girls. Yeah, yeah.
Voice like honey. The most beautiful voice on the planet.
And it's a lovely little bit of homage to that era of filmmaking.
Makes everybody, you cannot be unhappy when you listen to that.
No.
Bit of music.
It's a lovely bit of music. Well, we should wrap up.
Yeah.
And get on with the rest of the day.
We'll do another one of these because I need to introduce you all to the creative team, but I'll do that next time.
Yeah.
And take you through tech as well, because it's going to be a very exciting tech.
It will be. And we're heading into week 3 rehearsals. You've got another 3 weeks to go? 2 weeks to go?
Yeah, but remember there's Easter in the
Easter's
middle.
Easter's in the middle of it. Then we're into tech, then we're into previews. So we'll be back with more stuff.
See you soon.
See you soon.